Welcome to the podcast masterclass from Ginger Wizard Productions. If you're wondering how to do podcasting, you've come to the right place. I'm Nick Wilmshurst, and I make podcasts for other people for a living. I used to work in BBC Radio for more than 20 years, and now I'm bringing all of that experience of working with sound and getting the best from other people to you. In this series, we're going to look more in depth at the tips and tricks you can use to make your podcast sound great by speaking to people who really, really know what they're doing. Coming up in today's episode,
I could just take loads of little clips and hammer them all together and poof, that's the kind of thing that can really bring it to life.
And a little bit of this.
A lot of people aren't very good at recording good audio. And I just think if you're starting out, there's no excuse these days not to do it yourself. Start a podcast with a mate. It's the discipline of having to record it every week and edit it. So it'll make you quick, it'll make you fast, it'll make you good at hearing the key clips and quotes.
But before we get stuck right into today's episode, which is all about producing your sound, and ask of you, please leave me a review and subscribe. It really helps us out. And of course, you'll be the first to know when a new episode makes its way to your favourite platform. It's all a win-win-win. And don't forget, if you hear something you want to comment on, a suggestion of something you think I should cover, or maybe you just need my help, you can email me, nick@gingerwizard.co.uk. And on today's episode, we're going to speak to a guy called Tim Johns. Now, you may or may not be aware of Tim. Tim in the world of production, I think, is regarded as a little bit of a genius. Let's find out more about him. He's with us now. Tim, how are you? You work with Jeremy Vine. You have done for many years, just so people know. And you're here with us today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Jeremy Vine's quite a genius. I'm not sure about me, but it's very kind of you to have me on.
Let's get the simple stuff out of the way first of all. Just so we're absolutely clear, because a lot of people listening to this want to get into podcasting, or maybe they already do a podcast. So they may not be aware of really what goes on behind the scenes in a radio show, for example, like what you do. So just describe to us exactly what it is you do.
So I'm a producer with Jeremy Vine, as you say, on Radio 2. And I'm one of a modest team. So there's an editor who's my boss. And then I'm one of a handful of producers. And we have some assistant producers too. And how it works is we get in the morning, we look through the day's news. Our program's mandate is to reflect the national news agenda. So it's very much what's already out there and how do we bring that to a mainstream audience in a big way at lunchtime on Radio 2 that's also got some fun in there as well. We have a morning meeting at 10 past 8 where I and my colleagues take it in turns to pitch stories of what we should cover and maybe how, what question we should ask, what guests we should book. The editor says, right then, we'll do that, and that. And then we have from about 8.50 until ideally about 10.45, so a kind of two-hour window to book all the guests, write the scripts, do the background research, get that all kind of ready to brief Jeremy when he rushes in the door, fresh from Channel 5, because he does a Channel 5 show in the morning. He runs in, we give him the scripts, we brief him on the stories, get him up to speed, and then from 11.30, Vernon Kay, who's on before us, says, oh, hi, Jeremy, what have you got on the show today? And that's where we start getting comment from listeners, because we're half a pre-set-up show with set-up interviews and guests, and the other half of each item is kind of phone-in, really, with listeners. So that's, and then the show's on, and it's all hands on deck to process comments from listeners and get good listeners on air. And then we collapse in a heap at two.
Right. Let's try out your party question answers here. So
I'm rubbish at these. I'll tell you. Don't ask me what celebrity I've met. I can't remember.
I wouldn't dare, actually. I hate that question because I can never remember. And I always just say Nigel Mansell because genuinely he was a pleasure. Right. Okay. What's Jeremy Vine like? Does he arrive sweaty when he bikes in? And this one is my own weird one, but I wanted to know, I bet he smells nice, doesn't he, in general? I bet he smells like a lovely man.
I've never been asked any of those at a party. No, I have been asked the what's he like question all the time, and he's very nice. I think anyone who's ever met him, if you did meet him, you'd think, oh, he's nice. There's a lot of people in our industry who are, well, your laugh says it all. Not very nice to work with, to be blunt, but he's not one of them. I've always gotten on with him, genuinely. We work well together. He's fun to work with. I like working on the show with him. He doesn't appear sweaty. I don't know how he does that in the summer.
Doesn't he?
Not really.
That's
not a long bike ride. He's doing a 10-minute shift there on the bike. But still, in the summer, I would be. And he smelled pretty neutral. I hope he doesn't correct me, but I don't think he's a particular aftershave kind of guy. He's just neutral smell, impartial.
That's disappointing because I was thinking he's a Paco Rabanne kind of guy, I think. But I stand corrected.
I may be wrong. I'm not a connoisseur of such things.
The reason we've got Tim on is because he is brilliant at making little bits of what we call in the trade setup audio before the guests appear on air. Check it. I think there's a lot of your stuff on SoundCloud. Am I right there?
A few bits. I've got fallen off the wagon a bit with uploading stuff. I used to have a massive archive on Audioboom, and then they deleted that website more or less. But yes, you can find a few bits on SoundCloud if you don't mind them being slightly outdated.
Well, no, I think that what we're talking about here is how you use sound to tell a story, which essentially is what you're doing with podcasting. And I wanted to ask you how they were generally driven. I mean, do you decide that you have something coming on and you need to jazz it up? Or do you decide that the item needs something else to give it a bit of a push on air?
Yeah, so I suppose it was a bit of an as and when question, depending on levels of staffing that day and so on. But certainly for a long period, many days a week, I might have been making a 2 to 3 minute package, an explainer, a setup piece of audio, as you said, to tee up an item and guests. And that'd be my editor saying, here's a topic that's fertile for that, off you go. And so I suppose my specialism in a way is to take a current news event and explain it in a fairly entertaining and engaging way with lots of little audio clips. So the perfect kind of story is something a bit complicated, maybe a bit of politics, something with lots of audio from the day before. Maybe it's been in the House of Commons or there's been interviewees out, and I could just take loads of little clips and hammer them all together and that's the kind of thing that can really bring it to life, I suppose. And if not that, I mean, I always have a rule that I say to people, it seems like a basic tip, but whatever it is you're producing, once you think you've produced it, just stop for a minute and think, what haven't I done yet? What haven't I thought of? And it sounds basic, but if you do something every day, you think, I've got my script, I've got my guests, I'll go and record now. It's like, oh, hang on, what's the thing you haven't thought of that could jazz it up? So if it's not a package that I've made, it might be that we look at our two guests, we look at our script, and we think, oh, actually, we've got time. You know, it's again, obvious, but we work in audio. So what piece of audio could we shoehorn in here somewhere just so that the texture of the item is a bit more lively, is a bit different? And that could be as basic as a sound effect or as interesting as an old archive clip of audio that's relevant or anything really. But no, in terms of using audio clips of any variety to try and bring a discussion alive that bit more, I'm a big fan of, if that's not too convoluted an answer.
No, I don't think it is, because I think what you're saying there is it doesn't have to be rocket science. You don't have to, because having done the job myself, sometimes you sit there really trying to be too clever, I think. And it's so easy to overthink things. And that sometimes even what seems like the most simple idea can actually add so much to what you're doing.
And this is a ridiculous example, but it's one that springs to mind for when one tiny sound effect completely changes the whole item. Unhelpfully, I can't remember specifically what the topic was, but we had the former environmental correspondent Roger Harabin on our program. And he was on for quite a while. And I think it was something like he was assessing listeners' energy-saving tips. It was something like that. So they come on and go, oh, I've got this idea, or I wear an insulated jacket indoors. Is that a good idea? And he's quite, I'm sure he won't mind me saying, a fairly serious man, took it all quite seriously. So that's nearly the item we did. At the last minute, I'm like, let's get an air horn sound effect, and he can play Harabin's Hooter if he likes an idea. And it changed the whole thing, because it went from, like, you had the same content about people describing their idea, his answers, but just with the insanity of, like, an air horn, like going mad at a disco rave. And you go, yes, I'll give that my horn. And it just really gave it a kind of very Radio 2-esque, silly, fun, lively, and crucially something that grabs you from the sandwich you're making. What's that horn going off again? Like one little sound effect, change the item. And, you know, we've got some very funny clips saved in our archive from that for a rainy day.
I love it.
That's brilliant.
So I think as we are already discovering, if you're meeting Tim for the first time, we know that he's a guy who loves the medium of audio. Let's talk technicals. What's your golden rule, your tick list, if you will, for what makes good audio good? And I know that's a really weird question, but we listen around. You'll do it yourself. Someone will say, oh, I've got a podcast. You think, great. You listen to it and the quality's not quite there. It's very distracting. For you, what's your, say, top three to make sure you're doing, to make sure that you're sounding brilliant?
Yeah, that's a broad question and a good one, and obviously key to what we do. And I wrestle with this because for many years my thing was, I'm quite a geek. I like good audio quality. I always tell people, get good at audio editing. It's really important. And I suppose conversely, my answer to that question is none of that really matters compared to the actual words spoken, the content. So my number one tip is don't book Tim Johnson for an interview. He's rubbish.
You're okay.
No, but seriously, it's the content and the stories and the scripting, which without that, you've got a failed product. You can have the best technical setup and a lovely microphone, but without that, it's kind of nothing. And the stuff that stands out there tends to be, meaningful, important, emotional. It might affect the listener's pocket in terms of it helps them with finances or health. It tugs at the heartstrings. You know, it's really interesting stories, really well told. So I guess that goes in at number one. I don't know if I'm going to get to number three, but my number two.
Just make something up. It'd be fine.
I'll make something up. Yeah, fine. My second point then is about audio quality. And it's, you'll know this as well, but it's surprising, especially in news broadcasts, it's really overlooked. A lot of people aren't very good at recording good audio and being good at audio editing. And I just think if you're starting out, there's no excuse these days not to, if no one's giving you a contract or a job immediately, or even if they are and you're still a bit green at it all, there's no excuse not to do it yourself in terms of get some free audio editing software, start a podcast with a mate. Doesn't matter if one person listens to it. It's the discipline of having to record it every week and edit it and get used to how that works. It'll make you a good audio editor. It'll make you quick. It'll make you fast. It'll make you good at hearing the key clips and quotes that jump out and stand out. And I think that discipline, like a blacksmith using a hammer, our tool is being good at editing audio, and people seem to forget that a lot. Get good at the quality. Number three, have fun.
I work with a lot of people who are making podcasts for the first time, and they work within big companies or big institutions, and they've asked the boss has said, yeah, make a podcast, make it about XYZ, brilliant, yeah, we'll do. And instantly, because they've had that conversation with the boss, they're already thinking, I need to sound good, I need to sound professional. And the fun element is so important because people don't like seriousness. I think even serious people don't really like that much seriousness. People like fun. We like to be entertained. And I think that's a good – in fact, I think number three is your best one.
Good.
And you just came up with it.
Thinking about it for years. How did I do it? No, I was going to say you're right. And I was thinking of when on our program Ed Miliband covered for a week, and he was a serious person, and we made him do a lot of things that people had never really heard that fun side of him, and he was really fun and people loved it, and so did he. So yeah, you're right. Serious people having fun. If you're interviewing the MD of your company for a commercial podcast, like, don't be scared of them. Try, they're just a human. They have their own thoughts on dogs and movies and films and Lord of the Rings, and get a bit of that in there as well, whatever the interview, if you can.
I think we should hear a bit of Ed Miliband, because that was brilliant. But that was with Napalm Death. Let's have a listen.
Once more with feeling. Do you do it once more, and then I'm going to do it. You're all right! You're all right!
No, more throat. Definitely more throat.
Just genius. Was that your idea?
Yeah, I had a press release from someone that I don't know. I was on a generic mailing list, and normally I'd have deleted it because it was like, do you want to cover news of the first death metal stage at Glastonbury? It's not really our thing on our show. But I thought, well, we could. What if he was offering Napalm Death? I thought, well, what if they could teach Ed Miliband to sing death metal? You'd listen to that. So that's what ended up happening.
It's a great clip. Let's talk about guests, because it can be a slog. You know, we've already talked about it, especially on Vine's show. You've got 2 hours. 2 hours to turn it around, sort all your guests out. And, you know, it can be a slog. Some people just don't want to appear on the radio and or podcast. So just tell us about your process of booking someone onto the show. What are your red flags? What are your tricks? And yes, folks, there are tricks for making someone appear on a program.
A tip I'd say is that I'm always non-committal at the start of a phone call, because the worst you can do is phone someone up thinking, oh, they're definitely going to be the right guest. And in your conversation with them, and that's a key part of it, it transpires that they're not quite right. Yeah, I mean, you'll know this full well, but there's a balancing act between you having an idea and trying to find the guest to fit into it, and not ruling out people because they say something slightly off script. Of course, they should be entitled to do that. But when it's when they're saying something that just doesn't fit, you need to be able to politely say, that's not for us today. I don't know about red flags. I mean, people who like pick up and with a string of expletives. that's a pretty good one.
Often a warning sign there, yeah.
Yeah, often a warning sign. I guess it's easier to go with what feels good and right. So we, like most programs, have a bank of regular contacts. There are a lot of pundits in the wider media who we make heavy use of, and it's a kind of pecking order. So often we mostly cover news stories. Mostly we try to get as close to that story as possible. So who was there? Who saw the thing? How local can we get a reporter to be? And then it's a sliding scale of like, okay, we're running out of time. Who can read a page of information and regurgitate it well on air? Who is a general great commentator in the sphere of the liberal left who likes umbrellas? You know, it's a sliding scale from specialized to general. Sometimes people who are very close to the story, you know, the average person on the street, if you said, can you go on Radio 2 in 30 minutes and be very articulate for 3 minutes on this topic? It's not easy to do. So you also have to balance up. They may be close to the story, but really a terrible communicator. Is it fair on them? Is it fair on the audience to use them? So you're making all these micro judgments. I mean, to boil it down very simply, I always like to phone people and have a brief conversation with them. If they're a politician, a pundit, they're used to it. You don't need a long chat with them. You can normally tell within two sentences if they're a good communicator. But I think that initial chat is so important if you're scouting for guests, rather than doing everything by email, which a lot of companies and corporations tend to do these days. You need to kind of know how they're going to sound on air. So I think having that phone call where possible, where appropriate, is absolutely the thing to do. And not committing at the beginning so that you can say at the end, great, well, if we do want to speak to you, we'll call you back.
I love that trick.
The other bit of your question was how to persuade people on.
Yeah.
We're quite lucky. I mean, we're a big outlet in terms of audience numbers and size, and a lot of people know that. They either know that and they're keen to come on, or they, for whatever reason, don't like the program or don't like the particular outlet, or so that it's probably never going to happen. So I guess some basic things are just being polite, courteous, putting yourself in their shoes. We do get people who are brand new, pick up the phone and go, hello, we're talking about this, can you come on? And it's like, that's a proper cold call. You've blindsided them. You know, you don't want to waste their time, but a bit of small talk where appropriate. I'm talking about good phone manner and just being polite and a decent person and just assessing, have you got a minute to talk? That's the first thing I'll always say. And the second thing I say is like, potentially you're free at this time. Right, let me tell you why I'm calling. So I just think a bit of politeness, a bit of context, a bit of imagining what it's like for them getting that call goes a long way.
It's funny, isn't it? I think a lot of phone manner is something that's a dying art. I think a lot of, and I'm not going to generalize by saying young people, I'm not going to do that. But a lot of young people aren't very good at it, Tim.
Yeah, it's so true. And I try and avoid saying that because it does make you sound like an old man with no offense. But it's understandable because the vast majority, as old people, grew up having to communicate on landlines. So it's just normal to pick up a phone and go, hello, this thing. And actually, for a whole generation, you very rarely make a phone call unless it's, well, often planned, like, oh, can we chat on WhatsApp? And then you have a call with your closest mates, but not a lot beyond that. So it's quite an alien notion to just, as we would call it, phone bash, call after call. Can you come on? So it takes practice. It just takes a bit of practice. And I know it can be quite unsettling, anxiety-inducing to, like, cold call often, important or famous people, especially if you ever get a placement on a big program. It's like, you can be asked to call quite senior people who in that world still are quite busy and don't really care about your program. So it can be quite daunting, but it's a practice thing, and just try not to be scared or shy of it.
Do you think in the world of podcasting, people need to start taking more risks? It's because, the general thing about podcasting at the minute is it's very person A, who is the host, talks to person B, maybe C, about subject X, and that's the show. Do you think people need to start thinking slightly differently? Can you see the future of podcasting heading in that direction, where a lot more thought goes into the pre-production and the thought process?
Yeah, I certainly don't want to be critical of any podcast that exists, but I suppose people talk about the amazing burgeoning, ballooning market, podcast market, and a lot of it is commercially driven by the success of taking one or two well-known people and talking to the pre-existing fan base they already have about a subject that their fans like. So that's the model which has driven a lot of the expansion. I suppose the other part of your question is partly a commercial decision, because if I were running a podcast company, would I take the risk? Taking risk takes time, takes money, takes potential failure. So it's easy to say, yeah, come on, risk it all, but it's difficult to say unequivocally yes. So I suppose my answer is, if you've got a good successful podcast format and it's working, do that thing where you stop and think, what have we not done? How can we improve it? How can we add different features? Can we make it more dynamic so it's not 40 minutes of speech? Can we break it up with archive and clips? Can we, just how can we improve the pace and rhythm of it beyond what we already have? And I think to that, yes, I think more podcasts could be more like that and less like an hour and 20 minutes of nonstop speech.
Let's talk about COVID. We all remember it. I mean, how long ago is it since the last lockdown? Maybe a couple of years at this point. But it still feels weirdly far away, yet very still recent. I don't know. It's an odd thing. I was very much working radio during that time, as were you. How did you find it? I mean, this is completely irrelevant to podcasting and all the rest of it. I just think it's interesting to talk about, because we were probably one of the few types of people that were out and about during the strictest of lockdowns. How did you find it?
It's very surreal to think back on it. And because I work in central London and I lived in Bedford, so that was my commute. It was like 45 minutes on the train. It went from a busy, stressful, weird commute to, like, I have a whole intercity carriage on this train to myself, and it was surreal. I guess everyone's experience was subtly different. I think mine was a very positive one, and I count myself very lucky for that. The reasons being, no close personal friends or family were seriously ill with it. Our family had it, our whole team had it really early on, like right before it all broke. So I felt like I had a bit of a shield, so there wasn't the anxiety of worrying about catching it, because I'd just had it. So that first lockdown, that first weird period, was kind of positive. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people who were in a similar situation in terms of being lucky not to be really ill with it will remember the sunshine. We had a young child. I was doing some working at home. It was all just a surreal, like, what is happening here? We pared our show down quite a bit because of, like, everyone grappling, how do we do this working from home hybrid business? So it wasn't work. Work was important. It felt important because we were just communicating so much about this virus and what was happening, but also we kept it simple so it wasn't too stressful. We relied heavily on certain guests and correspondents to do a lot of that heavy lifting. So personally, selfishly, it was all right, and it felt like our show was important as well, so I suppose that's satisfying. And again, this is probably an experience shared with many people. The later lockdowns, that was all just a bit like rubbish because it was a halfway house. Things were busy when they shouldn't. Some rules were in place for too long. Some rules were just randomly ditched. It was just like that kind of middling mess. And the support started to dry up and hospitality and other sectors started to struggle. Medics had really been through it and had enough. So it was a crazy time, wasn't it? And it was odd to be in a kind of non-vital, you know, I'm neither a bin person nor a medic. It's not like vital infrastructure, but here we are doing my office job like in work during the lockdown. It was quite odd.
I'm like you. I feel slightly guilty and maybe even a bit ashamed that I enjoyed it so much. But it was, I found it, you know, a wonderful time because I biked into work. I was 4:30 in the morning on empty roads into an eerily empty city. I mean, that, you know, that mind-boggling. And at the end, I'm not sure whether you found this, but when you went into the studios, you were probably, you know, just such a select four group of people. Well, we were four, you know, maybe more on your team, but, you know, we were four people separated by different rooms and stuff, but we were lucky. We got to go and spend time with each other out of our homes. We got to leave the house. We got to, you know, experience what it's like to work in the center of a big city while it's shut down. You know, that was so weird. And, you know, hopefully we never have to experience it again. But I was listening to people talking about it the other day. I can't remember what it was on now. Awful memory. Comes with age, Tim. And it just suddenly came back to me how special that time was. And it was very much certainly a time that I think a lot of people fell in love with radio and they fell in love with podcasting. Certainly our relationship with our listeners at that radio station at the time, it changed. It completely changed. You know, we became their, more so than ever, we became their mates. You know, it was a very strange time.
Yeah, it was. We did a piece. What was it? It was kind of towards the end of the first stint of COVID. And it was, there were rainbow pictures popping up on social media all over the country. So there'd been like a lot of rainstorms and sun. And we just closed the show with, we played like Over the Rainbow, and Jeremy did this little monologue about how we'll all see each other again. And we had little clips from listeners that are regular listeners just on with like messages of who they were looking forward to seeing. We played that and it was just like oddly emotional. And it felt like we'd all been through this collective, we had this collective mad experience and so odd to be in the middle of it. And then it really felt emotional. There was a deeper connection between program makers and listeners. And, you know, I mentioned the regular experts and guests we had on, a real sense of praise for them from the audience. Like, thank you so much for like holding our hand through this. So yeah, I think you're right. So, some listening habits and connections between broadcast and listeners definitely deepened. Some went like that, thanks to anti-vaccination misinformation, but that's a whole other topic.
Oh yeah, let's not go there. You're right. Tim, finally, I have to ask you about this because famously you have an issue with this. What's your problem?
The good old record scratch. By the time I die, maybe I'll have completed my campaign to eradicate it from our industry. Look, I'm sorry if you've used the record scratch, and if you're moderately in any way progressing your career, you will have, because everyone does at some point or is asked to. I don't, look, here's the secret that I shouldn't confess, but I don't mind it too much if it's used in a creative way. But broadly speaking, I don't like the record scratch sound effect because it typifies, again, sorry if I'm talking about you, but it typifies lazy production to a point in that it's just so glaringly obvious and cliched and hackneyed that it's a good example of a thing where you can think, how could I do this differently? And it's so like, this thing was happening. It was all lovely. And then, record scratch sound effect, this happened. It's like, yes, I have heard that before. Is there a different way to tell that story? So as I just become old and cynical, I just thought, why not campaign to eradicate that sound effect?
Well, that's where it all went off the rails with Tim Johns. Thank you ever so much indeed for your time. It's been lovely chatting to you. It's nice to get nerdy, geeky, and altogether, hopefully not uninteresting, but, you know, I hope it's given people some insight and, you know, people take something away from it.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Take care, Tim. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
What a pleasure it was to talk to Tim. What a lovely guy. That's about it from today's episode. In the next one, we'll be looking at confidence. If you're a host and you need a bit more confidence, what can you do? See you next time.